You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. Might there be motion from Congress on data privacy legislation? Maryland passes a pair of privacy bills. A database allegedly from the EPA shows up on Russian cybercrime forums. HHS issues an alert for the healthcare and public health sectors. CISA gears up for their cyber storm. A leading UK veterinary service provider suffers a cyber incident. A hard-coded backdoor is discovered in deprecated network-attached storage devices. NSA's new cybersecurity director takes the reins. Our guest, Caleb Barlow, CEO of Cyberbit, shares his insights on the evolving role of the CISO and the bull market for 0 days. It's Monday, April 8th, 2024. I'm Dave Bittner, and this is your CyberWire Intel Briefing. Thank you all for joining us here today. It is great to have you with us in between the time that you are spending safely gazing at the solar eclipse. I wouldn't get your hopes up, but Congress appears to be nearing a breakthrough on data privacy legislation with the unveiling of the American Privacy Rights Act, APRA. This bipartisan effort proposes significant restrictions on how companies can collect, retain, and utilize consumer data, limiting it to what's necessary for their services. It empowers users to opt out of targeted advertising and manage their online data, including corrections, deletions, and downloads. A key feature is the establishment of a national data broker registry, mandating an opt-out option for data sales. The proposal addresses Americans' desire for more control over their personal information, targeting big tech's data practices, and ensuring user consent. The APRA attempts to navigate long-standing legislative divisions, particularly around preemption of state laws and individual legal recourse against privacy breaches. It incorporates stronger protections than existing laws, allowing for state-specific regulations on civil rights and consumer protections, while including provisions from California's privacy law for lawsuits related to data breaches. Enforcement focuses on larger businesses, exempting small companies and certain entities like government organizations. Despite its comprehensive approach, the APRA's success remains uncertain as it enters a discussion phase for further refinement and support. Meanwhile, on the state level, the Maryland legislature has passed two major privacy bills aimed at regulating tech companies' data collection practices, especially concerning consumers and minors, despite significant opposition from industry giants like Amazon, Google, and Meta. The Maryland Online Data Privacy Act introduces broad restrictions on consumer data collection and usage within the state. The Maryland Kids Code specifically targets the protection of users under 18, banning tracking and manipulative tactics designed to keep them online. Lawmakers say these moves signal Maryland's commitment to establishing robust data privacy protections, aligning it with states like California and Connecticut. However, tech industry challenges are anticipated, particularly from groups like NetChoice, which has previously contested similar legislation on constitutional grounds. The success of these bills hinges on Governor Wes Moore's approval. positioning Maryland as a potential leader in the national privacy legislation landscape, pending inevitable legal challenges. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is contending with a significant data breach impacting over 8.5 million users, attributed to a hacker known as USDOD. The breach has exposed sensitive personal information, posing risks of identity theft, cyber espionage, and could deter environmental violation reporting. The leaked database includes contact information for customers, contractors, and staff, with details such as full names, phone numbers, email addresses, and job titles, but thankfully no passwords were compromised. The data is now circulating in Russian cybercrime forums, which underscores the breach's potential for misuse and phishing scams, targeted marketing, and state-sponsored espionage. The incident highlights vulnerabilities in protecting critical environmental and infrastructure data and raises alarms about the chilling effect it could have on future environmental reporting efforts. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has issued an alert regarding sophisticated social engineering attacks targeting IT help desks within the healthcare and public health sector. Attackers are using detailed personal information, likely harvested from professional networking sites and open-source intelligence, to impersonate employees, particularly in financial roles. By tricking help desk personnel into enrolling new devices for multi-factor authentication, these threat actors gain access to corporate resources. Their main objective is to obtain login credentials for payer websites to redirect legitimate payments to their controlled U.S. bank accounts, eventually transferring these funds overseas. Additionally, some attacks have involved AI voice cloning techniques to enhance their deception. To combat these threats, HHS recommends several mitigation strategies, including requiring callbacks for verification, monitoring suspicious account changes, and training help desk staff to recognize and respond to social engineering and spear phishing attempts. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency is gearing up for its biannual Cyber Storm exercise, an event designed to simulate responses to a large-scale cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure. This month's exercise, which is the ninth of its kind since 2006, will involve over 2,000 participants from both government and various critical sectors like healthcare, finance, and energy. The event aims to test the effectiveness of the National Cyber Incident Response Plan, which CISA is currently updating. The exercise unfolds over a week, presenting participants with hypothetical scenarios to test their preparedness and response strategies without revealing specific details ahead of time to maintain operational security. This year's Cyberstorm is particularly timely, given recent warnings about hackers targeting U.S. infrastructure, and aims to enhance readiness for inevitable real-world incidents through a collaborative approach. Leading UK veterinary service provider CVS Group has experienced a significant operational disruption due to a cyber incident involving unauthorized access to its IT systems. The company, which operates vet practices, laboratories, and crematoria across the UK, Australia, and the Netherlands and Ireland, took immediate action to isolate the issue and temporarily shut down its IT systems to prevent further breaches. Although the specific nature of the cyber attack remains under investigation, it has characteristics of ransomware. CVS has engaged specialist consultants for a forensic analysis and informed relevant authorities, including the Information Commissioner's Office. While it has managed to restore IT services to most of its practices, increased security measures mean some systems are not fully efficient, causing ongoing operational impacts. The incident has spurred CVS to accelerate plans for migrating its IT infrastructure to the cloud. For our U.S. listeners, we note that CVS Group in the U.K. is unrelated to the U.S. healthcare and pharmacy company CVS. A significant security flaw affects several end-of-life D-Link network-attached storage models, allowing for arbitrary command execution due to a hard-coded backdoor account and a command injection vulnerability. Discovered by threat researcher NetSecFish, the vulnerability allows attackers to remotely execute commands on affected devices by sending a Base64 encoded command through an HTTP GET request. Over 92,000 vulnerable devices have been found online. D-Link has acknowledged that these models are no longer supported, advising users to replace them, stating that they won't offer patches due to the device's end-of-life status. Dave Luber has officially taken the reins as the new cybersecurity director of the National Security Agency, succeeding Rob Joyce, who retired on March 31st after 35 years of public service. Luber, with over 30 years of experience in various significant roles within the NSA and U.S. Cyber Command, will now lead the agency's cybersecurity directorate. This directorate aims to combat cyber threats against the Department of Defense, National Security Systems, and the Defense Industrial Base. Luber expressed his commitment to building upon the team's achievements and enhancing collaborations to bolster cybersecurity defenses. Coming up after the break, my conversation with Caleb Barlow, CEO of CyberBit, with his insights on the evolving role of the CISO. Stay with us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. And it is always my pleasure to welcome back to the show Caleb Barlow. He is the CEO at CyberBit. Caleb, welcome back. You know, my colleague Rick Howard and I were recently chatting about the CISO at SolarWinds, who was recently brought up by the SEC on some federal charges here. This is something I wanted to check in with you on. What's your take here? Any insights?
Well, I think there's two things we have to look at. And there's, you know, part of what we probably should acknowledge first off, Dave, is in the cybersecurity industry, anyone following these things on LinkedIn, there has been an enormous amount of backlash from CISOs that are concerned that, you know, when you charge a CISO on criminal charges, that is that going to encourage people to maybe go choose a different profession? And of course, you know, I think one of the other things we have to acknowledge is more often than not, a CISO is walking into an environment where the environment is not pristine when they start, and they're doing everything they can to improve the environment. But even when they finish after 2 or 3 years in their role, it isn't necessarily, you know, all the I's are not dotted and the T's are not crossed, right? This is a constant game of cat and mouse. So, you know, we've seen two examples of this that are really high profile. One, of course, was the CISO at SolarWinds. The other one was the chief security officer, Joseph Sullivan at Uber Technologies, who was actually sentenced to 3 years of probation and 200 hours of community service. And that you know, those set of charges really came forward more from the FTC versus the SEC. So two different regulators really not only going after companies, but the individuals. So I think it's time to have a little bit of a different perspective here. So not that the concerns that people are raising aren't valid, but let's also remember the other thing CISOs have been talking about, Dave, is the real desire to have a legitimate seat in the boardroom and to be viewed on their peers like the CFO, you know, the head of HR, the CTO, et cetera, right? Even the CIO. And, you know, here's one of the things I think a lot of people don't realize is I had the opportunity to spend some time in the seat of a public company CEO. One of the first things you learn real quickly is you are personally liable before stockholders and what may happen. And in certain situations, you are pretty much guaranteed to get sued, and you are pretty much guaranteed to get named in a lawsuit yourself. And if there is anything that goes awry at the company, any number of regulators are going to name you personally. The same is true for the CFO. Now, how do you protect yourself against that? Well, first of all, and I can guarantee you this, it changes your posture on everything you do. It changes how you communicate. It changes how you think about what you do, because you know you're personally going to get named in this or liable if you cross a line. Now, the second thing you do is, you know, you go get D&O insurance. And you know, so director and officer insurance. And I'll bet you a lot of CISOs have no idea, until I just said it, what D&O insurance is. And it's something that they want to be talking about with their executive teams to make sure they're covered under the company's D&O insurance, particularly if they're a public company, but even if they're private. And you know what D&O insurance covers basically is errors and omissions on the part of a executive. And it's very expensive insurance, but most companies of any size have it. Now, the other thing to recognize in this is, let's take the example of a CFO. Now, a CFO also has to meet certain regulatory guidelines. They have to be audited. They have to be audited by third parties. And there's an audit committee on the board. I think this is where security is moving towards, is a very similar type of approach where, just like the CFO, you know, if someone's cooking the books, the CFO is absolutely going to raise their hands and say stop. And they're going to have the authority to do that. They have direct access to the board and the audit committee on the board. We need to move to a posture where the CISO is in a similar role. There's an outside auditor that helps them review the security posture of the company. There's a security committee on the board made up of experts in security, which largely don't exist in boards today. And, you know, that CISO actually has to be able to have that authority to raise their hand, particularly in the light of the CEO, and say, no, this isn't acceptable. These high risks we must fix. And if we don't, then we're going to need to disclose that. And that is a lot of where we're seeing this, you know, these approaches go, where they're basically holding these CISOs liable. So I guess my point here, Dave, is if we want the CISO to be viewed as kind of a legitimate seat in the boardroom, we also have to take on the responsibility of that seat.
I couldn't agree more. And who do you suppose has the ability to make change here? Is this a matter of stockholders saying that we demand this position be elevated? Is this the CEO saying that? The other board members? How do we get to where we want to be here?
All of the above. But also keep in mind, one of the things that pushes public companies in this space today is, you know, there are a variety of trolls that go out and buy public stocks and just look for opportunities to sue those public companies. It's a horrible side of the industry, but as much as I dislike it, it does drive and force good behavior, is, you know, kind of all this activism that occurs. So if you make an error in a financial statement, even a small error, you're pretty much guaranteed to get sued as a public company. it's unfortunate, but it's the reality. And, you know, it could even be a small, minuscule error. And more often than not, those lawsuits will get settled because they're not even worth taking to court. Well, you know, it won't take long before the same type of thing starts to happen on a cybersecurity posture, where we start to see a company, and, you know, SolarWinds is a good example of this, where maybe what they said externally and in their SEC statements is everything's fine, don't look here, you know, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. And if the reality is different underneath, that's an opportunity for a shareholder lawsuit. You know, my point in all of this is I think it's going to come from everywhere, but the mechanisms are already in place to force this. You know, we're just catching up with where the CFO has been for a lot of years.
Yeah. I can't help thinking that a position that already suffers from a lot of turnover, the CISO, you know, people don't tend to stay in that position very long. And granted, there's a variety of reasons for that, but I can't help think that this is going to just make that worse, to feel like you have a target on your back. You know, you have all the responsibility with none of the, you know, the actual benefits of sitting on the board. Who's going to want that job?
Well, I think you could have said the same thing about a CFO, yet there's all kinds of people trying to get in line to be public company CFOs, right?
That's fair.
So,
sure.
So, but here's the point. It probably changes the, let's just call it the level of corporate maturity of who takes that job, right? Mm. It takes on a very different persona of who's going to take that job, their bona fides, their experience, their education, what they've done before, and their ability to operate at this kind of executive level. If anything, what I think happens is it continues to elevate that position and elevate the training requirements to take that position.
Hmm.
But I don't think there's going to be any shortage of people willing to take it, because at the end of the day, companies are going to need a CISO and they're going to have to pay for someone that has that kind of qualifications.
Yeah. All right. Well, Caleb Barlow, thanks so much for joining us. Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And finally, the market for zero days, hacking tools that exploit unpatched software vulnerabilities, has seen a significant price increase, with values reaching millions. CrowdFence, a startup company that acquires these tools to resell primarily to government agencies, now offers up to $7 million for iPhone hacks, $5 million for Android, and between $3 and $3.5 million for browser exploits. This price hike reflects the growing difficulty of hacking devices and apps due to enhanced security measures by companies like Apple and Google. The rising costs also indicate the complexity and team effort required to develop these sorts of exploits, compared to the past where a single researcher could find and develop a zero-day. Amidst global tensions and sanctions, the industry faces ethical and legal scrutiny, especially when exploits may target individuals in countries with contentious human rights records. At these prices, our social media influencer desk wonders how long it will be before online trendsetters stop bragging about the high cost of their mobile devices and diamond-studded cases and shift to the multi-million-dollar valuations of their potential security weaknesses. Stranger things have happened. And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. Don't forget to check out the Grumpy Old Geeks podcast, where I contribute to a regular segment on Jason and Brian's show every week. You can find Grumpy Old Geeks where all the fine podcasts are listed. We'd love to know what you think of this podcast. You can email us at cyberwire@n2k.com. N2K Strategic Workforce Intelligence optimizes the value of your biggest investment, your people. We make you smarter about your team while making your team smarter. Learn more at n2k.com. This episode was produced by Liz Stokes. Our mixer is Trey Hester, with original music by Elliot Peltzman. Our executive producers are Jennifer Iben and Brandon Karp. Our executive editor is Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.